From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the April 2016 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Punch cards, porridge and a pittance. This month we celebrate 5 years since Bletchley Park's oral history project began in earnest. More than 300 veterans of the Government Code and Cipher School and its outstations during World War II have been interviewed in that time, mostly by a team of dedicated volunteers. And we want to hear from those who've yet to contribute their memories to this rich archive. We'll also give you details of an exciting new open-air cinema at Bletchley Park, which will show the Oscar-winning film The Imitation Game, as well as the World War II classic The Great Escape, over two nights in September. Before all that, though, the letter which cemented Bletchley Park's place in history has come out of the shadows and is on public display for the first time. This was a personal thank you letter from the US five-star general Dwight D. Eisenhower at the end of World War II to Sir Stuart Mingus, wartime chief of the Secret Intelligence Service. It hung for several years on the wall of the top secret office of the chief of MI6. It was there during the tenure of Sir John Scarlett, now chairman of the Bletchley Park Trust, who launched it to assembled media in March.
Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, Office of the Supreme Commander, 12 July 1945. Dear General Mengies, I had hoped to be able to pay a visit to Bletchley Park in order to thank you, Sir Edward Travis, and the members of the staff personally for the magnificent services which have been rendered to the Allied cause. I am very well aware of the immense amount of work and effort which has been involved in the production of the material with which you have supplied us. I fully realize also the numerous setbacks and difficulties with which you have had to contend, and how you have always, by your supreme efforts, overcome them.
I am here today at Bletchley Park very proudly to unveil the original letter sent to General Sir Stuart Mingus, Chief of the Secret Intelligence Service and Director of the Government Code and Cipher School, by General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Commander, Allied Forces Europe, and signed on the 12th of July, 1945. The existence and text of this letter first became public knowledge in September 2010 with the publication of Professor Keith Jeffries' authorised history of MI6. And I am going to say here that Keith Jeffries, sadly, a wonderful historian, passed away recently. It was previously known to me for the very good reason that for several years it was hanging in my office when I was chief of the Secret Intelligence Service, but of course the office was secret, so I knew about it, other people didn't. I was, of course, proud of the letter. General Eisenhower became the first commander, subsequently, of NATO, and then, obviously, President of the United States, and he is one of the great names of the 20th century. General Mingus is rather less well-known, as befits the head of a great Secret Service. But he was well known to me as my predecessor, our third chief, and one of the greatest, an officer who led the service throughout the Second World War and beyond, in a post which, since 1923, had included responsibility for the Government Code and Cipher School, known as GC and CS, throughout the war. And this is the direct forerunner of GCHQ. In August 1939, approximately 200 members of GC and CS came to Bletchley Park. In January 1945, well over 8,000 men and women worked at Bletchley Park, and several thousand more worked at stations inside and outside the United Kingdom. This huge increase in numbers reflected success, outstanding success and contribution to victory in 1945. Now, as noted, I was consciously proud of the Eisenhower letter. But even as a long-standing officer of the service and one who had always taken a close interest in service history, I did not fully appreciate to what General Eisenhower was referring when addressing his, I quote, heartfelt admiration and sincere thanks, close quotes, to the director and staff of Bletchley Park with these words, again in quotes. The intelligence which has emanated from you before and during the campaign has been of priceless value to me. It has saved thousands of British and American lives and in no small way contributed to the speed with which the enemy was routed and eventually forced to surrender. And as I have said elsewhere, General Eisenhower didn't write letters like that every day. Now, only when you look at the detail of what happened immediately before and during D-Day, and when you see the confidence Eisenhower placed in this intelligence when taking remarkably brave strategic decisions, do his words begin to take on their full meaning. It was vital intelligence from Bletchley Park, and it was supported, of course, by reporting from the brave British agents on the ground in occupied territory and reporting from the French resistance. And, again, of course, in Eisenhower's mind, would have been the contribution from Bletchley Park to the campaigns in North Africa, Sicily, and the Atlantic, to list the most obvious critical campaigns. In brief, the work done here was a very big deal indeed, although I'm not sure they would have used those words at the time. This letter was written by the Supreme Allied Commander, a great American, to a great, if discreet, Britain. It was written in the spirit of the unique and special relationship between these two world powers, a relationship which was born here at Bletchley Park on the 8th of February 1941 and continues, as I am in a position to know, in great strength to this day. Above all, it acknowledges and reflects the unique spirit of Bletchley Park and of the men and women who worked here, a spirit captured very well by William Bundy, Bill Bundy, head of the American cryptanalyst, who worked in Hut 6 as a young man and later became Assistant Secretary of State, having advised Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. Again, I quote from Bundy. I had other jobs with superb people, important and worthwhile pursuits. But certainly for me, this was the high point. This was a totally dedicated group, working together in absolutely remarkable teamwork. It was an extraordinary group in an extraordinary organisation. Thank you very much. Read the letter.
Tony, you must see so many historical documents in your job, but is this a little bit more special than some of the others?
It is, and I think there are two reasons why. Firstly, it's Eisenhower himself, the Supreme Allied Commander, saying what the contribution of Bletchley Park has been during the war. I think it's interesting that where some academic historians in the latter part of the 20th century talked about, oh, it took 2 years off the war and things like that, I think Eisenhower's judgment that it hastened the German rout and it saved thousands of Allied lives is really interesting. Partly because he humanises the value of the intelligence into the number of lives saved. But I think also because it reminds us that all of the work at Bletchley Park, all the tremendous intellectual work that went into cryptanalysis, is fundamentally only happening because there's a customer who needs that information. What Bletchley Park enabled General Eisenhower to do was have, in a very 21st century expression, complete information dominance. He knew what the Germans were doing. The Germans didn't know what he was doing. There's a real reminder to people who work in intelligence that the people that we are providing intelligence for, the people who are really doing the difficult and dangerous work, and our job is to help make that as easy as possible for them. The other point that I take from the letter is one that Eisenhower doesn't spell out. But he's an American general who's commanding British and American forces. Bletchley Park, by the end of the war, had hundreds of Americans who were integrated into the work of the organisation. And I think it's really important to realise that that level of integration between the UK and the US, both at the military level and at the intelligence level, was something that started here. Started in February 1941, but by VE Day, by the time Eisenhower's writing this letter, the integration is so complete that it's not even something that he feels that he needs to highlight.
And it's something that we still benefit from even today, isn't it?
We do, because of course what had happened during the war, the governments in the two countries decided that it would be a good idea to carry that on in peacetime, and both at the intelligence level, the formal agreement between the UK and the US to continue intelligence cooperation was signed early in 1946. But we also see through NATO the fact that the US didn't abandon Europe, it stayed in Europe, and that the alliance that had begun during the Second World War continues to this day.
People might look at what is really just one 75-year-old piece of paper in a glass case and think, what's so important about that? But there is something really important about it, isn't there, David?
That piece of paper is vitally important to us because it is proof of the significance and importance of the work that was done here during the war. We could have put up a panel saying we think this work is very important, and that would be fair enough. But in the case of this letter, we have a firm opinion by someone who was there at the time and who was in charge of the whole thing, Eisenhower, as head of the Allied Expeditionary Force, saying what Bletchley did was absolutely vital. Of priceless value is the phrase he uses. So we don't need to say it because he said it for us.
It also goes back to the fact that it was never a foregone conclusion that we were going to win World War II, was it?
Absolutely not. There's a perception nowadays that the Allies were always going to win in the Second World War, that we had a predominance of kit and equipment, men. Eisenhower himself is very worried that, for example, the D-Day landings might fail. He had a speech written, prepared for that evening to go on the radio to apologise to people in case the operation was a disaster. So he was aware that it was a very closely contested thing. And so for him, anything that gave him an advantage over the Germans was absolutely crucial. And of course, the signals intelligence from Bletchley is a massive part of that. He has a very full understanding of where the Germans are, what equipment they've got, what their plans are. And that is vital to him for fighting the battle. Not only in knowing what the Germans are doing on the battlefield before the invasion, but also in understanding what they're anticipating, where they think the invasion is going to happen. And part of that is famously the Double Cross operation and Operation Fortitude, where intelligence is being deliberately fed to the Germans, misinformation about a potential invasion in Calais. And one of the things Bletchley Park is able to do is listen to various forms of German internal communications, which show that they've swallowed the bait. We're able to say with some confidence that Hitler still believes the invasion will be in Calais. And of course, so long as he thinks it's going to happen in Calais, he keeps troops there rather than in Normandy, and that helps the men on the beach to succeed.
And there's something really special about this piece of paper, isn't it? It just sings of history, doesn't it? The number of staples that have been in the corner, and as Sir John said earlier, it hung behind his desk for years. Seeing it really brings everything home, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a piece of paper that is of vital historical importance to us and to the Second World War in general. But what's interesting about it is it has clearly not always been that, because it's got holes in the corner where it was safety pinned to things. It's got punch holes down the side from where it was put in a ring binder. It's now in a case, beautifully temperature controlled and managed, and we treat it like the priceless object it is. But that clearly hasn't always been the case.
My name is David A. Hatch. I'm the historian for the National Security Agency in the United States. This letter represents the opinion of the five-star general who has led the Allied armies in the West against the Nazis, that the intelligence produced at Bletchley Park was an integral part of their campaign, or what Eisenhower called a crusade, against tyranny. It represents Eisenhower's recognition of the joint effort of American and British cryptologists in providing the information that resulted in wise decisions that were used to defeat Nazi leaders in battle. I think this letter represents a turning point in the life of Dwight Eisenhower, certainly, but perhaps the life of America as well, the life of the American and British relationship. Before World War II, no American officer had education or experience in intelligence, none that reached senior level anyway. Eisenhower had to be taught how to use intelligence, had to be taught, in fact, what it was. His intelligence officer, a British general, Major General Strong, taught him well on how to use intelligence in his decision-making process, and it served the Allied armies well in reducing casualties and shortening the time of war. This letter is Eisenhower's acknowledgement that this had happened, its importance in individual lives and the lives of the two countries. But the letter also has a second significance. Within 5 years after it had been written, Eisenhower was appointed the first commanding general of NATO. Within 2 years after that, he was elected president of the United States. In both positions, he was an astute user of intelligence in his decision-making, and he was so knowledgeable he could make improvements to the way intelligence was done. It all traces back to the time at Bletchley Park that this letter represents. Written in July 1945, it talks about the period from 1940 to 1945, but its significance resonates down to today. This letter has the ring of Dwight Eisenhower in it. I can't prove that no staffer touched the wording, but Eisenhower himself was a good writer, and he was sincere in what he would write as official documents. They were not just standardized forms to him. So I think there's a good chance that most, if not all, of this letter was Eisenhower's words himself. I believe it would probably also have been his decision that such a letter had to be written. We don't have the details, and I can't prove it, but it very much sounds like Eisenhower, who was not only a strategic thinker, but somebody who took care of his people. I've researched many original documents on Eisenhower's use of intelligence and use of SIGINT, and I believe that his knowledge of and his ability to use SIGINT and other intelligence materials in his presidency and in his commandership of NATO traces back to what he learned during the war itself, which traces back to much of the material that he received from Bletchley Park.
The intelligence which has emanated from you before and during this campaign has been of priceless value to me. It has simplified my task as a commander enormously. It has saved thousands of British and American lives, and in no small way contributed to the speed with which the enemy was routed and eventually forced to surrender. I should be very grateful, therefore, if you would express to each and every one of those engaged in this work my heartfelt admiration and sincere thanks for their decisive contribution to the Allied war effort. Sincerely, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Our thanks to Stephen Eric Wilson for playing the part of General Eisenhower. A classic war film and a classic in the making will be screened in the beautiful Parkland grounds of Bletchley Park in September this year. The open-air cinema will show The Great Escape on Friday the 2nd of September. Based on a true story, a group of renegade prisoners of war are put in an escape-proof camp. It's a story of two halves as we watch them outwit the camp guards, dropping pockets full of soil as they dig the tunnel, and then the second half sees them on their toes on planes, trains and boats as they try to make their way out of occupied Europe. And of course, we couldn't have an open-air cinema at Bletchley Park without showing the Oscar-winning film about the codebreaker, mathematician and early computer scientist Alan Turing. The Imitation Game will be screened on Saturday the 3rd of September. Book now on the Bletchley Park website. And here's a reminder why you simply have to see this film. And if you've already seen it, why you should watch it here at Bletchley Park.
What did you do during the war?
I worked in a radio factory.
What did you really do during the war?
Are you paying attention?
If you speak a word of what I'm about to show you, you will be executed.
It's beautiful. It's the greatest encryption device in history. The Germans use it for all major communications.
Everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Let me try, and we'll know for sure.
Mr. Turing, do you know how many have died because of Enigma?
No, I don't.
Three. while we've been having this conversation.
That was the environment where men and women from all walks of society, from all abilities, whether it be actors and artists to the more likely candidates of mathematicians and physicists and scientific thinkers, came together to try and crack a code that was basically, or many codes actually, that were the encryption devices of the Nazis, and they were winning the war. The country was starving, the clock was ticking. And to understand the importance of that is also to understand the importance of those men and women and the actual environments of where it happened. So to experience something of that through the extraordinary exhibits and explanations you get, both of the working environment and the tools, the actual, you can see the machine, you can hear the machine working, and it's amazing. You think from that came a reading of a code that basically won us the Second World War, some estimate by 2 years, and that meant millions of lives were saved. And it was all done in secret. And now we can look at that secret. So how could that not be one of the most important legacies we have in our culture of that era? It's incredibly important that it keeps going, incredibly important that it's open to the public and something that's well-funded and supported and continues, because this is our history.
To pull off this genius routine, one actually has to be a genius.
Why are you building a machine?
The machine will allow us to break every message and win the war.
You could help us, but you won't.
You will never understand the importance of what I am creating here.
I'm just a mathematician.
You've got more secrets than the best of them.
People who no one imagines anything of, who do the things that no one can imagine.
Five years ago, Bletchley Park's oral history project began in earnest, gathering precious and unique first-hand memories of veterans of the Government Code and Cipher School and its outstations during World War II. This rich archive has grown to more than 300 interviews, and this month we begin to celebrate its fifth anniversary by sharing the very first interview that was carried out under its auspices. We're celebrating 5 years of the Oral History Project, so let's start with the basics. Jonathan, tell me what the Oral History Project is.
The project is capturing the stories, the memories of all those who contributed to Bletchley Park during the war, either here or at the numerous outstations. And we've now interviewed, in the last, getting on for 5 years, about 320 different veterans.
What was the original driver to embark on this project and make it a solid entity, if you like?
Well, a few years ago, when I was concentrating on updating the Roll of Honour, it was obvious from veterans writing in that they had stories to tell and they would like to be interviewed, and we really didn't have the sort of organisation or the resources to do it. But then we were given a grant which enabled us to cover the sort of the travelling costs. And we then started doing it on a sort of a fairly low-key basis. And then after a couple of years of that, it was decided that my post should become, you know, the full-time oral history post. And we then recruited more volunteers. Not the entire UK covered yet, but we are getting much, much better coverage now.
It's an official record, isn't it, of what they did?
Yes, it is. I mean, we have interviewed one or two via Skype.
Be nice for their families once, if there's some way in the future that this can become available, they can find it and they can treasure that. When your loved ones are gone and with us no more, something like a recording of their voice, recalling their wartime memories, be just an absolute treasure. But beyond that, it's a piece of history, isn't it? You're building a jigsaw of what people did, what it was like, where they lived, what kind of social life they had. It's quite rich, isn't it?
It is, yes. We get all sorts of interesting stories, including one or two we have to be a little bit careful about repeating, but that's fairly rare. People tend to be very frank. They don't only talk about their work, but often they will talk about other individuals, you know, maybe long deceased. And I think they're seeing it as an opportunity to be frank. They don't need to hold anything back anymore, whether it's about the work or their personal stories.
These aren't all public yet, are they? But that's something that's for the future.
We are posting more and more of the write-ups in full now on the Roll of Honour.
Not to put too fine a point on it, and I'm sure our veterans would say this for you, and they probably do in quite large numbers, haven't got forever to gather these,
no,
have we?
No.
And have you noticed a shift in those 5 years towards it becoming more difficult?
I wouldn't say it's shifted particularly, because there are still veterans now who are new in the sense we've only heard about them in the last, say, few months, may have made contact with us, or their family made contact with us, and when we go and interview them. And unlike some of the veterans who've been involved with Bletchley Park for about 20 years now, to them it's very new, and the family in particular are often a bit nervous about how much they remember. Some of them, these interviews, their memory is fantastic. It's not just their memory is fantastic, they've prepared for the interview, which I think is quite important, and we have got a lot out of those. I think we could still be doing this for a few more years. Although the youngest veteran, I was going to say he's 90, but I think we've just had contact with someone who's 89, so one of the very youngest. We have interviewed people who are over 100, so there could be another 10 years as people live longer. You know, a lot of them are still very active, both mentally and physically. And there are still people out there who don't know that we're here to commemorate their wartime work and eventually find something in the media, or their family mentioned something. Bletchley Park, you were there, weren't you, Dad? Or you were dealing with them. And they contact us. We tell them about the commemorative badge and freedom of Bletchley Park, the privileges they can have as veterans. And then that leads to the next question. Would you like to be interviewed? You would say yes.
It's a source of extraordinary pride for their families as well. And it's usually the people themselves who are quite modest about what they did, because at the time it will have been downplayed for them and by them. And they at the time will have known that they weren't in active service, risking their lives every day on the front line like so many were. And so that tends to lead to a great humility, doesn't it? And modesty about the work they did. But it was so very important. And I think it does something, perhaps, in a small way, to help the way people perceive older people. And that, you know, they're not just an old person. It's not just about where they are and who they are and the life they're living now. They've got this whole rich history. And this little window of 6 years, they could have done something absolutely incredible.
That's right. And I think what often comes across is that they were given this work to do, they didn't quite understand what it was. They knew it was important, but hey, they were young, get on with it, you know. And they did know it was important for winning the war. So even if it wasn't fully explained to them what they were doing at the time, a lot of them have read up a great deal with all the things that have been published. And they are very well informed about the wider picture, as well as what they were doing at the time. Well, at the time, they didn't know.
Well, that's when and how they find out how important it was, isn't it? It's the context that they've learned since the mid-70s. And you're still looking for people to get in touch if they have a relative who worked here, or one of the outstations was connected with it and has their memory yet to contribute.
That's right, yes. Anyone who was involved, what the modern term is signals intelligence, so worked at Bletchley Park, worked at one of the bomb stations, at a Y station doing the intercepting, special communications unit, special liaison unit, maybe worked for the post office building Colossus or maintaining equipment here. We'd like to hear from them. So if you have relatives who did that, I mean, first of all, check if they're on the Roll of Honour. If they are, then great, then get in touch with us. If they're not, get in touch with us. We'll make sure they're on and contact you about interviewing them. It goes without saying, family members, friends can be present at the interview. Often helps, because they can prompt things in the heat of the moment with this recorder thrust in front of them. They may have forgotten, you know, so the family often very useful prompts, and or maybe something they're too modest to talk about that they need to be reminded of. So yes, we are still very keen to interview people, definitely.
And what we would hate for any veterans to think is that their little bit wasn't important enough, and that we wouldn't want to hear about it.
We do occasionally hear in conversation that, oh, I wasn't very important, you wouldn't be interested, and we persuade them otherwise, and of course we go and interview them and get a really good story. We want to hear from as many bomb operators as possible, as many Y service interceptors as possible, but cooks, drivers particularly, I'd like to hear from, because how on earth did they move all these people around Bletchley Park? I'd love to hear from a cook. We get the other side, what the food was like.
Yeah.
Some liked it, some didn't. So any cooks out there, let's get the real story of how you coped with all this.
Doris Marshall, née Phillips, lived just outside the boundaries of Bletchley Park, and her family welcomed a number of billetees who worked here. They suggested to her when she was coming of age that she too might work at this highly interesting, top secret place. As we go through this year, we'll bring you memories from more of these fascinating oral history interviews. And we want to hear from anyone who worked as part of the Bletchley Park operation and has not yet been interviewed. Now back to Doris and her memories of punch cards, porridge and being paid a pittance.
I'm talking to Mrs. Doris Marshall, who, as Miss Phillips, worked in Hut 7 and Block C at Bletchley Park from 1941 to 1945. Doris, tell us a bit about what you were doing before you became involved with the work of Bletchley Park.
I worked for an insurance company. They were evacuated to Bletchley because of the war, and I was too young to work in Bletchley Park, so I took this job. And it was a very interesting job, because they were all Londoners. And I first of all became a filing clerk, and then gradually I worked up the ladder and get improvements. And people would apply for benefits, and they had to pay, had to buy stamps, and then we'd have to assess whether they were eligible for these benefits. And actually, it was a wonderful place to be because we only worked 5 days a week. And after Bletchley Park hours, I mean, when I got to Bletchley Park, I couldn't believe the hours they expected us to work.
But before that, of course, you had an interesting story, as your family was already living at Bletchley Park before it became...
We went there in 1937.
Can you tell us a bit about that, please?
Well, my father bought this place. Of course, we never thought about there being a war in 1939, but it gradually built up. And it was a very interesting place to be in. And then when war was declared, I was only a youngster, and I thought, oh, gosh, that'll be a lot of fun. I bet that'll be interesting. But, of course, I mean, I was just being a child. Mm. It was a very nice place to be in, anyway. Mind you, I did rather resent the hours because we had to do night shifts and 4 o'clock till midnight, midnight to nine, and only one day a week off.
So how did you actually start working at Bletchley Park? How did that come about?
Well, it just came because all the billets we had, Major Shiner, Brooks and Cocaine, said, well, Doris, when you get to 18, you'll be called up. Mm. So I suggest you apply for a job in Bletchley Park. We've lived in your house for over a year, and we know you very well, and I'm sure that the local people, like the rector at the church, because we went to church quite frequently, will give you references. And so I applied and got the job.
And did you have an interview for that? And did they ask you what sort of skills and qualifications you had for that?
Well, I had to tell them what I'd been doing prior to that. And then, first of all, they sent me to a school in the mansion, and I had to learn how punch card operating. And I was there for about 6 weeks. And then they sent me to the Hut 7, and I had to utilise what I'd learned at the school. And that was all punch cards. And but I didn't really care for that very much. It seemed a bit boring. And then I got sent on to Freeborn's place.
So when you applied for the job, did they tell you anything about what you were going to be doing before you actually started?
No, they didn't. We had to find the Official Secrets Act. Mm. And we mustn't, not even with each other, did we have to tell each other what we were doing. And it's most imperative that we didn't, because, you know, if there happened to be a spy amongst us, they would have got out and we'd have been.
Of course.
Mm. So but we had to, the Official Secrets Act lasted till 30 years after the war.
Yes. Mm. Once you'd started there, did they explain that the work was to do with intelligence?
Well, we knew it was all hush-hush because of the official, we didn't ask questions.
No. Can you remember how much you were paid to start with?
An absolute pittance. I certainly wasn't going to get rich out of what they paid me. But anyway, we thought it was our duty to do it. And I think we got £2.10 a week.
Yeah.
And out of which I can't remember what we paid for our meals, because we used to have meals in the middle of the night. We'd go on at 4 o'clock and finish at midnight, and we start at midnight and get off in the early morning. And so we used to have breakfast and dinner in the canteen. And that was the only time we could really converse with each other, because we weren't allowed to talk to each other, any distraction. It was a very, very tiring job. I know I had to go home and go to bed, and all the people from the camps were walking past the door, so I had to get some hearing aids so that I could hear them.
What was the food like at Bletchley Park?
Yes, it was quite good, if you like porridge.
Back to Mr. Freeborn. He was the man in charge. Was he a friendly person you could sort of get on with and have chat with?
A lot of people said he wasn't, but I found he was very kind to me. But he had been, I was born in Canada, and he'd been living in Canada, so he had got that in common. And Freeborn called me back. He said, when you come back, Doris, I won't be here, because, you know, I've got some time off, but I want you to do this particular job. Anyway, by that time, the rest of the girls had gone over to the cafeteria, and I thought I'd take a shortcut. We didn't have lamps or it mustn't show a light of any sort because we didn't want to attract the enemy that was anything going on important there. And I went across this piece of grass and I fell into the ditch. And some of the girls thought it was funny that I hadn't caught them up, and I was shouting for them to come and help me out. I couldn't get out. I was covered in mud. And so they all come running back. And if they hadn't, I'd probably been there till the morning. They pulled me out and took me across to the cafeteria. And the old ladies that were on duty, they went and took my shoes and stockings off and took my coat and loaned me some things to go back to work in. And when I went back for breakfast the next morning, they got it all cleaned up and ready for me to go back to work.
So people looked after each other?
Oh, yes, we were very kind to each other.
Yeah. So how do you spend your free time? Sounds like you didn't have much, but when you did get it, what did you do?
We went to all these concerts and things, and there was a tennis court, we could play tennis, and then this army camp was built just opposite to our house, and they would have concerts and parties there. So as we were so close, they used to come and invite me to go, and my sister. No, we were never dull. I must have, the thing I suffered with mostly was exhaustion.
Can you tell us a little bit about concerts that your mother used to do? I believe she was a piano teacher.
She got a degree from the Royal College of Music. And, of course, these billets loved it because they loved to sing, and they always used to bring we used to sing the arias from Madame Butterfly and gather around the piano, and we had a lovely time with them. They're so nice.
Did you do any music or drama yourself?
Well, I was in the choir, and my brother was in the choir. My sister wasn't because she couldn't sing. But my mother played the organ and she trained the choir. My father had a lovely voice and he was home from the First World War, come back to England, he'd been on the Somme, and he went to call on his parents, and my mother was teaching his sister music. And of course he loved to sing, so he picked up the music and sang away and she played. And so that was it. So she persuaded him to go back to Canada with him.
So what was your father doing during the war? Was he actually running the...
Well, he was running... He continued to grow vegetables and things in the garden. There were fruit trees all on the wall. And he was terribly busy. And then he sold the produce to Bletchley Park. And they gave him a contract to go around to other farmers to buy Brussels and things from them. It kept him very busy.
We've spoken about time off, but how much actual leave and holiday did you get?
Oh, yes, we'd get about 3 weeks a year. And we had some lovely holidays. And I went to other people's homes, and one of them lived in Hastings. Oh. And one of her sisters married a fellow who had a fleet. They used to go out fishing. And we stayed with her mother-in-law. And every morning, they got in from fishing all night. And we used to have fish for breakfast. And she used to go out and buy fresh bread rolls for us to eat. So we were very well looked after.
And what did you tell your family and your friends outside Bletchley Park about what you were doing?
Well, we couldn't mention it. We couldn't tell them what we were doing. I mean, you'd really been in trouble if you'd heard it.
One thing we haven't spoken a great deal about, perhaps is the most important bit, was the actual work you did. So what I'd really like to try and do is, if you could describe as much as you can remember about what you were actually doing at work and what the output, if you like, of it was.
Well, the machines varied quite a lot. And you had to learn to wire them up, for each job was different, and it's like a radio wires and things.
These were the Hollerith machines, is that what you called? You did call them that, yes.
And then there were several different machines doing different jobs, and all depends on whether they thought you were capable of or not. You know, can you do this, Doris, and you do that, because they thought they were better at one job than the other. But we never discussed what we were doing. It was very difficult to hold a conversation with even with the people you worked with.
So did your bosses explain what the product of what you were doing was, or is it just something that you got on with and didn't think?
Well, it was all in code, so obviously it was a secret. And, well, we never asked them, really, because if the other girls had been heard what we were saying and they weren't to be trusted, they could have got out, didn't they?
Of course, yeah. And did you sort of have any work relations with other bits at Bletchley Park, or was it just concentrated on your section?
No, we didn't have anything to do with anybody else.
When you'd been given a task to do, I know you said you weren't fully explained what it was about, but did you feel that what you'd produced at the end of it sort of made more sense, was more of a finished product than when you'd started it?
Honestly, it was very difficult to assess it, really. Mm. Even I couldn't, because all the machines were different. They're all turning out a different way of looking at things.
So Churchill just came around on the one occasion?
He did the V sign.
So you got it right if he did that.
He was a charming old boy, though.
Yeah.
And he shook hands with Miss Ford, and he had a cigarette, and apparently picked it up and threw it on the floor, and she picked it up and she said, "You're going to keep it for a souvenir." He was a wonderful chap. He was certainly the right man at the right time.
So the equipment you were using, you've said a little bit about it. How big was it? Was it sort of big as a chest of drawers?
Yes, it was about as big as a piano.
Yes, yeah.
That's one of the machines we had.
Yeah.
And you can have what you call a tear-up. One of the cards would become slightly damaged, and as it was running through the machine, it would block the machine up, and all the cards coming up behind it, you have to be very quick to turn it off, and then you'd have to take the card that was causing the trouble back to the punch room, and they would punch out the cards again.
Yeah.
It really held you up because it was, quite time-consuming.
Yeah. And was it very noisy? Did you finish a shift with your ears ringing?
Oh, yes. Yeah. It was too noisy to talk to each other.
Yes.
We never had much conversation with each other unless we were going across to the cafeteria. Yeah.
So were you ever told, as you did your work, that what you'd done had contributed to a particular event in the war, a particular operation or victory even?
Well, I remember one incident when something to do with the Poles. They were prisoners of war and... The Germans gave them a job of making these machines, which was hush-hush, and they mustn't talk about it. And apparently the Poles got hold of this idea and sent it back to Bletchley Park.
Oh, yes.
So that we were informed on what they were doing before they did it,
yes.
Which was very, very useful to us.
Mm. Which buildings did you work in? Did you start off in one of the huts?
I worked in Hut 7.
Yes.
We outgrew Hut 7, so I was transferred to Block C, I think it was.
Now, I understand, of course, that your late husband was also involved with,
yes,
with similar work.
This is Roy's secret wireless war, yeah. MI6, in 1939 to 1945. As soon as the war broke out, he was sent to West Africa, and he came back with malaria, which affected his whole life. And then when he got over that, he was sent to Moscow, and everywhere he went, he was followed. And he went to the Bolshoi Ballet one night with somebody's people that he worked with, and... They were supposed to be back because of the curfew. And he couldn't get out because the people were so tightly packed. Anyway, he did manage to get out with another fellow. They managed to get towards the door and get out. And the Germans arrested them and put them in the Kubalanka prison.
The Russians arrested
them? Yes,
So they're arresting their allies.
Roy says... For the first time in his life, he ever mentioned that he was frightened. Yeah. Anyway, some people from the embassy, because he was working at the embassy, they went rushing back to the embassy and told them what had happened, and they went and got them out. But he had some quite exciting, not exciting, but rather dangerous positions to be in.
As far as you know, he was part of the network that got the Bletchley Park reports to the people who needed to know in West Africa,
yes,
and our people in Russia.
He was very self-sufficient sort of man. He could work on his own quite well because he wasn't with a group all the time. He was always on his own.
Yeah.
Sometimes he'd be shouting in his sleep after he got his malaria, and I'd say, "What's wrong, Roy?" He said, "Please don't talk about it. I'm not allowed to." He's well chosen, really, because a lot of men couldn't be trusted to keep the information to himself like Roy did.
How did you meet?
At a dance at Bletchley Park.
Oh. Of course. And so you couldn't say what you did and he couldn't say what he did.
No, I didn't know.
No.
And I thought, I haven't heard from Roy. Perhaps he didn't like me after all. Then I'd get a card back, but never from where it was from. And one of his friends that were coming home on leave or had finished his job would come up and say, "I got this from your husband." He never said where he was. But being quiet about what you were doing is most imperative, really, because,
yes,
you know, it could have been used against the country.
Yeah. That's an interesting point, because years later, you and thousands of others suddenly heard or started reading about this place called Bletchley Park.
I know.
So how did you feel when it all came out?
When the 30 years expired, we could tell people what we were
doing. Okay, yeah. Hence our conversation now.
You don't want to get locked up, do you?
No. And so war came to an end. What did you do then?
Well, to start with, I got married. I don't think there was a start. No, I wasn't first, because when he came back from Russia, he had a burst appendix. and had to go into a hospital in Luton. And he was in the hospital for quite a long time.
Yes.
And then we finally got married. And then we had a trip to Canada, which was very interesting. I flew out and Roy went on the Corvette. And I flew to Montreal. And then I caught a train to Toronto. Mm. Yeah. And all the people in the carriage kept coming up to me and saying, I was travelling first class, and they said, you're English, aren't you? And I said, yeah, oh, we do think you're in a wonderful race. You think I'd won the war on my own? And here's my card. If you need any help, bring us up.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah. Canadians are like that, I find.
Oh, they're lovely. Well, I'm a Canadian. Yeah. We went to Australia and bought a business, didn't we? We've done it all.
Yes.
I haven't got much left to do, so I shall have to go soon.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.